are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, March 9th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, assistant professor of political science at UC Irvine, author of The Anger Gap, How Race Shapes Emotion in Politics, Davin L. Phoenix will be with us. Also on the program, on the eve of six key primaries, Joe Biden opens a big lead in the polls. She'll see. Meanwhile, Biden launches a super PAC as the DNC changes the rules of the next debate format to make Joe feel a little more comfortable. Meanwhile, Booker and Harris endorse Biden. Jesse Jackson endorses Bernie Sanders. Warren, still on the sidelines. Meanwhile, at the White House, Mick Mulvaney jettisoned Mark Meadows, new chief of staff. As the main question is, will we follow or exceed the Italian glide path as COVID-19 causes 19 million people to be quarantined in northern Italy? And the White House overrules the CDC attempt to warn elderly not to fly. Meanwhile, CPAC and APAC cause congressional self-quarantines. And Pelosi and Schumer urge paid sick leave for victims while Bernie will be holding a COVID-19 roundtable in Detroit. Tom Friedman's best friend, MBS, detains his family in a Saudi power grab.
It's happened a couple times before, hasn't it?
Yeah, why not? Extended family now. Former Blackwater head, or I should say, head of the former Blackwater. I don't know what they're calling it this week, Jay or something like that. Betsy DeVos's brother, Eric Prince, has been recruiting ex-spies to work with James O'Keefe and Project Veritas.
Academy.
Academy. They just change it every 6 weeks. And the yield curve drops below 1% for the first time ever in history. We will explain why that's probably not a good thing and more.
Line goes down, folks.
On today's program, apparently the stocks suffer their worst drop since 2011, just moments ago. It's a crap storm, ladies and gentlemen. We got a lot. I mean, today is it's a crap stormy day. I'm not going to lie to you.
It's going to be a crap stormy week.
It's going to be a crap stormy week.
Happy birthday to me.
I was just about to say that, Jamie. I was just about to work that in.
Aw.
Yeah, I had it right here on the top of my sheet. Happy birthday, Jamie.
I'll pretend I didn't say anything.
Hey, folks, my son had his birthday this weekend, but today is Jamie's birthday. What better way to celebrate than to be here on a day where we're like in the, you know, the buildup to the COVID-19 panic and also the Michigan and Washington state panics for Bernie's campaign.
Yeah, well, if one of us dies, I'm really going to miss you guys. So let's get it while we can.
Exactly. We're going to make this the best birthday ever. We will talk about all that and more later in the program. I guess we could do this. I mean, folks, we are about a week away from really getting a sense, maybe a week and a half from getting a sense of just like how much what we're going to be facing in this country on some level. If you look at the Italian glide path, we'll talk about it in a bit. Let's skip this one and go to the one that we were originally going to do, because stocks are falling because just I think coincidentally I think an OPEC deal fell apart and oil prices are dropping precipitously. That is going to impact the U.S. economy significantly because a lot of our fracking in the Dakotas, I believe, survives because of the price of oil. When the price of oil becomes too low, it's just not worth it to spend all this money to frack. Good for the planet. Going to be tough on the economy at a time where we're about to hit, I think, a major, major problem with our economy because of COVID-19. Lost time at work, lost productivity. They're canceling, all sorts of conferences, tourism. There's all sorts of industries where I think you're going to see basically just take a powder. South by Southwest canceled. A lot of productions you're going to see are going to be canceled, particularly like commercial productions, whatnot. That's going to hurt in a lot of areas. But I mean, across the board, we're going to see a lot of this. But don't worry, Donald Trump is on the case. We will get to that later. But here is Donald Trump. There was a major tornado in Tennessee, and he could actually be down there for a rally, or at least in that area. I'm not 100% sure about it. Or he could have just decided, like, I need to go show leadership. And here is Fox News capturing some of that leadership. Folks, Donald Trump is nuts in a myriad of ways. But one of the ways that I think he is nuts relative to other human beings is his sociopathy, right? Is this sociopathy or psychopathy? I mean, and look, this, I'm not being clinical here. I don't know. But it is stunning, his inability to be aware of other people's pain. And here he is. He has latched on to a story of a boy who got lifted up in the midst of the tornado and deposited, like, you know, like two blocks away. And he wants this to be about a miracle that could only happen to this boy in this tornado.
It's a special time.
At a time when he's president. Just because it's Trump time. It's a Trump miracle. Here it is. And just listen to what he has to ignore to maintain this narrative.
Whatever you can do, it's tough. A lot of them have lost people within the family. One family got entirely wiped out. There was one case, though, I heard a young man was, an eight-year-old boy was ripped out,
yes,
flown to a certain area, and dropped off at the street two or three blocks away. And they found him walking. And he said, I just flew in the air. And he was walking down the street two blocks away from his home. And how did his parents do?
We're not for sure exactly how they turned out.
They were found deceased.
They were deceased.
The only surviving member of the household lost his sibling as well.
So it took him, and he said, I was carried by the air away from my house. He came back. But his
house over there, yeah, and dropped in the neighborhood back behind.
He was over there. And his parents were killed.
And his sister.
So we're going to go see some of the folks.
I mean, so you really just stepped on my whole story about the because
That's a pretty great story.
A lot of them were entirely wiped out, but one of these had a sort of Harry Potter situation of the boy who lived, and he was floated two blocks down. His entire family was wiped out, but anyway, remember, think about what it must have been like to have been that kid just flying.
He's flying around. He's
maybe there's some cows also flying around in a puppy.
It's a real Trump miracle. Just ignore the other part. Just ignore the other part, because that's in the way of the story.
Imagine Obama saying, like, yeah, one of those families was wiped out. Just entirely wiped out.
Yep. Just got... But there was that story about the kid who floated like a witch.
200 yards.
Alice. I mean, what's that?
Wizard of Oz.
Wizard of Oz. That's right. And then what happened with the other family? They died.
Oh.
Oh, they're deceased.
But anyway, still cool about the kid, right?
Yeah, right. But there's still, that's pretty amazing. Unbelievable.
Unfortunately, though, I was making this point. I think it might be good propaganda value for his, like, it leaves that image of, for like his types of followers of just like, oh, that kid, it's kitsch, right?
Right.
Like,
yes. I mean, and that may be the case, but what's really more relevant, I think, is like, now you understand how this guy could basically be running the government as a way of like, let's just keep a lid on talking about this COVID-19 thing, because that's the most important thing. It's going to go away eventually. And if people don't realize it's happening, that's not going to work. And, you know, we're going to talk more about what's happening with the primary and whatnot, but, to the extent that Donald Trump's political fortunes are, to the extent that there's anything that is out of Donald Trump's reach, it's quite possible that the implications of the coronavirus, both in terms of like, I mean, look, you have the flu, people die every year, and there's only so much you can do about that. The response to this has been so flawed that there is undoubtedly going to be hundreds, if not thousands, probably thousands of people who will die because of the response. There, in any situation, we were going to have people die. But because this response has been so poor, we will have thousands more who will die. We will have a tragedy in that respect. We're also going to have a major shock to our economy. The biggest problem is, of course, that we do not have the capacity, the added capacity that we need. We do not have, particularly because, you know, our system is so for profit. And I imagine this is the case with a lot of other places to some extent. You know, China, they can build within 3 days, it seems, like they can create an extra 1,000-bed hospital in any given place. We don't have the ability to do that. And we have no extra capacity in the system. The system is built with an awareness of how many people are going to need beds, how many people are going to need X, Y, or Z type of treatment because of the flu. In this instance, this is an add-on, and we do not have the capacity to deal with the potential of this add-on. And so the whole game plan is you mitigate and you sort of try and spread the sickness out over time, so that at least your system can sort of absorb it. It's not coming in one big sort of chunk, as it were.
They're talking about like Manhattan morgue capacity, for instance, like things like that.
And beds and morgue and whatnot. I mean, it's just not there. And part of the problem is that we went from, we're not moving quick enough to the mitigation strategy because we don't have the ability to tell where we are in the growth of the disease because of the failure of our government to perceive this. We had as much time as probably any country out there, frankly, any industrialized nation, And to do anything about it, to create a testing regime, to adopt the World Health Organization testing if necessary. But we didn't do any of that. And frankly, you know, across the board, we were sitting here from the last debate, which was, what, 2 or 3 weeks ago, and we were saying, like, why aren't the Democratic candidates making more of this? It should be. Something more should be made of it because, you know, a little bit of concerted reading would have told you, like, something's coming. It was, you know, I think the first story we reported on this that made our, you know, headlines, I think, was that plane that was come back where the Trump administration overrode the CDC recommendation. And one gets the sense that there's a whole lot of that going on. But we will talk more about that as the show progresses. And we'll get into, you know, I think this the author we have today on the anger gap, I think it's very apropos for basically where we are. But let me just tell you a little bit about my betting. Yeah. I think you know. This is one of the things that I have come to realize as I am older now. Small changes to what you do on your everyday life can make a big difference in just the way you feel, the way you approach your life. The right towel makes you feel better in the morning slightly, then you don't yell at your kids or whatever it is.
Yeah, it's also kind of the only luxury available to millennials, I think, is like, let's buy a slightly nicer version of the thing you already need.
I think that's true. But I'll tell you something. Here's the benefit with Brooklinen. You can make all these upgrades with Brooklinen, and it's not going to cost you a fortune. Brooklinen is the favorite, the internet's favorite sheets. They're also a home to bedding, loungewear, towels, with more than over 50,000 five-star reviews and counting. And now they have all of those life essentials, Jamie, that you were talking about. Shower curtains, bath mats, robes, totes. The final details that make your big upgrade. And the thing for me that I like, you know, I'm a huge fan of all the bedding. I'm about to move into the towels thing. That's my next purchase. But all the bedding, I will say, is this. Feels great. Looks great, does not break the bank. And it's luxury bedding. And I used to skimp on these things and just not even think about it, really. And Brooklinen actually makes it easy for me not to think about it anymore and get top quality stuff. Brooklinen.com is the perfect place to start making small changes that makes big differences. Brooklinen is so confident in their product that all their sheets, their comforters, I got a bunch of those, both sheets and comforters from them now, loungewear and towels come with a lifetime warranty. So go on, make yourself comfortable. Get 10% off your first order and free shipping when you use the promo code MAJORITY only at brooklinen.com. That's brooklinen.com, promo code MAJORITY. And hey, New Yorkers, if you're listening, you can get the internet's favorite sheets and more in real life. You can visit Brooklinen's first store in Brooklyn at 127 Kent Ave. That's in Williamsburg. Right off the BQE. Brooklinen, and everything you need to live your most comfortable life. Folks, I think you know that my style is one just generally a little bit more like function over form, probably, I would say. But I've been upgrading. I don't know how you would describe your style in one word. Simple, sophisticated, adventurous. Well, however you dress, stylists at Stitch Fix can help you find your new favorite piece. Stitch Fix is an online personal styling service. It delivers your favorite clothing, shoes, and accessories directly to you. First, what you do is you go online, you complete a style profile. They ask you questions about what kind of clothes you like, et cetera, what type of brands. Then an expert personal stylist will send you a handpicked box of items based on your preferences. They have men's, they have kids' boxes, they have women's boxes. No subscription is required. You can pick between automatic shipments or only getting new stuff on demand. Shipping, exchanges, and returns are always free. Plus, the $20 styling fee is automatically applied to anything you keep from your box. So I got my first box, what was this? I don't know, about a month and a half ago. And for me, the two biggest finds were these penguin, how do you describe them? Desert boots. They're a little bit more nicer than that, but they're that style. They're nice, like boot shoe, as it were. Like that's the problem I have. I don't even know what to call these things. And I wouldn't know to pick them out. And so I say broadly what I like to the stylist, and they send me these, my favorite new pair of like semi-dressy shoes. I mean, for me, everything is dressy. And I got a pair of Flag and Anthem pants that I love. But I have a tough time finding pants that I like. It's great. Now you can get started today at stitchfix.com/majority. Get an extra 25% off when you keep everything in your box. That's stitchfix.com/majority for an extra 25% off when you keep everything in your box. And lastly, as you know, it's an election year, which means it's time again for us to hire a president of the United States. And I think in many of your perspectives, fire one. But you know it's difficult to determine who is the most qualified. Maybe not for a lot of us, but there's some controversy as to it, maybe amongst our listeners, between two people. I mean, I like to think we have a broad audience. But even if you research it, each political candidate, for a lot of people, it's very difficult. Thankfully, not every role is this difficult to fill, especially when you have ZipRecruiter. Today, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. This is like the ad where they should have included us, right? They talk because we talk about politics and one of our top hires, he's definitely in our top quartile of hires, came from ZipRecruiter. What they do is they send your job to over 100 of the web's leading job sites, and they don't stop there. They have this matching technology. They scan thousands of resumes for people with the right skills, people with the right experience, and then ZipRecruiter actively invites them to apply. It is so effective, ZipRecruiter, that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Day one, ladies and gentlemen. So you could try ZipRecruiter for free. My listeners can go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority, M-A-J-O-R-I-T-Y. ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter, it is the smartest way to hire. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to be talking to Davin Phoenix about his book, The Anger Gap, How Race Shapes Emotion in Politics. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor, Assistant Professor of Political Science at UC Irvine, author of The Anger Gap, How Race Shapes Emotion in Politics. Davin L. Phoenix, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Davin, let's start with the I guess let's start with just the concept of the anger gap. Like, what? Just walk through, or maybe we should just start with the idea of like, let's talk about the anger gap and how anger is, or what the conventional wisdom is that makes politicians appeal to anger.
Sure. So I think
we're no strangers to anger operating in politics. Excuse me. On both sides of the aisle, you kind of see people responding to threats that make them feel indignant, and that kind of indignation over those threats makes them more likely to take action in politics. And we can break down what makes anger such a palpable emotion that can make people kind of move off the sidelines onto the playing field. You know, when I'm angry, I feel slighted. I feel like someone or something has violated some kind of norm, and I want to right that wrong. I feel an overwhelming motivation to restore order. And so I'm going to be more impulsive. I'm going to be less risk averse, more willing to act now and think about the consequences later. I like to joke with my students, you know, how many of you have ever said, oh, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that, I was angry. But in that anger state, you know, we're ready to take action. And so we're no strangers to seeing politicians make appeals to people to get out and vote or to donate or to canvass to make things right, to change that dissatisfying status quo. So I wanted to really explore whether all racial groups kind of respond to the same sets of threats, the same sets of dissatisfying status quos with that anger. And I'm finding, no, it's not the Quakes. I'm looking at kind of presidential candidates or partisan animosity or kind of 2016, that storm in general. I'm finding African-Americans expressing a lot less anger over those kinds of objects and targets than their white counterparts. And that has real consequences when we're thinking about black participation, specifically in elections. Not only are black people not participating, but expressing less anger than white folks, but when they are expressing that anger, it is not translating as effective to political actions, particularly back actions shaping elections.
Okay, so let's and I want to just like go take a couple of steps back first by when we measure this, like this concept of there's two elements, right? It's like how much anger is any given set of politicians in any given year sort of offering, and then how much of it is being received. I mean, do we have a sense of like, have there been elections that where the politicians are sort of using anger more or less over the years? How fluid is that? And then I want to ask this sort of the receiving question as well.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. We can certainly see that the effectiveness of any kind of appeal to anger is largely going to rest on the circumstances around people, right? So what are people evaluating political actors, particularly at the national level, on? I mean, well, it's the economy, stupid, right? That's the kind of the primary thing. When times are particularly tough, it's easier for the candidates, particularly those on the outside looking in, to draw up that sense of anger. But also we can think about other indicators of restlessness, right? So, of course, we have plenty of restlessness right now between disease epidemics, tanking economy, and just, you know, continued reserves of resentment, and bitterness over the Trump administration. So appeals to anger are going to be much more effective here than they were in, say, 2012, when certainly you had some your typical kind of incumbent fatigue for Obama, and you had an economy that was slowly but steadily recovering. Anger appeals aren't going to be that effective, and I think we can look back on Romney's campaign and see he wasn't able to necessarily make credible appeals.
Davin, apologies. So you were saying about Romney.
Sure. So when we look at the 2012 election year, we saw Romney was not able to really rely very strongly on appeals to anger, because beyond the kind of resentment or conservative backlash towards Obama represented by the Tea Party, in the general election climate, there wasn't that much to be angry about. The economy was slowly but surely recovering, and beyond your typical incumbent kind of fatigue with Obama, there wasn't that many unsettling events or circumstances to create that sense of, you know, something's wrong, maybe to be righted. And so perhaps we can see some of that manifesting in Romney's struggles in 2012, not being able to rely on kind of a fervent, indignant base of people really dissatisfied with the status quo. So yeah, to answer your question, we can see anger appeals being more or less effective depending on kind of how many credible threats there are to people's satisfactory status quos in any given political, economic, or even global environment.
And let me ask this before we get into sort of the meat of what you look at from a party perspective, right? I mean, you know, and largely like you can't really talk about the cohort of black folk when you're talking about the Republican Party. You can, but it just seems, you know, I don't know if like statistically speaking, it's a valid sample. Maybe it is to a certain extent, but I mean, do we see did you have any look into a potential gap between parties?
I did. And so I find that typically Republicans are a bit more likely to express anger towards the out party than Democrats. And I think that squares with what we might expect about the Republican Party, kind of being a party that seems to be animated more by anger or resentment. And what's interesting is that the Republican Party, of course, has control over many of the levers of political power. But as I saw a commentator say the other day, there still is a great deal of anger over the perceived lack of conservative or Republican control over kind of the popular discourse, right? Over popular culture and that, right? So that we can even see that be kind of manifested. I'll never forget a few years back, quite a few years, I'm dating myself, the early 2000s, during the Bush, W. Bush era, at, I think, a nominating convention, they did, the Republicans, a big thing where they kind of did a Star Wars analogy, and the Democrats are their evil empire. And it's like the Republicans controlled the Senate and the House and the presidency at that time. If anyone's the empire, it's them, right? But what are they pushing back against? The sense that they don't necessarily control the national discourse the way that they want it. So the Republican Party has been very effective at identifying things there they don't have control, they don't have power, and really animating a sense of anger about that. Even if you look at the political landscape, they do have quite a bit of control and power and influence.
And so moving into you know, the sort of the heart of your work here, I mean, part of that could be a function of the fact that it's their party is largely, I mean, mostly white people. Right. And so let's talk about the specifics of the anger gap. We're talking about a gap between the inclination or the ability and talk about how those two things interplay between white people's inclination slash ability to express anger within the political realm and black folks' ability to do so. And then, you know, obviously you do the work as well on Latinos and Asians, but let's just stay there. Like what are we talking about? It, you know, does a sense of what accounts for the ineffectiveness, as it were, or the lack, if it is, or the subjugation of that anger within the electoral context amongst black people?
For sure. So when many African Americans are kind of looking at the political landscape, they are calculating a very different response to their expressions of anger. You can think about that large stereotype or archetype of the angry black man, the angry black woman, and how that creates a level of scrutiny or stigma that everyday white people might not get for expressing anger in the same or even more intensive ways. So we can think anecdotally, right? African Americans will be looking at a Trump rally and looking at the folks, you know, kind of yelling and screaming at media members present and screaming, lock her up, and, you know, having those kind of incendiary signs and cursing people out, and they think, oh, there's no way on God's green earth I could ever get away with, or a group could ever get away with having that kind of rally. Right? Black people can look at history and think about the ways in which black movements, whether they're radical movements like the Black Panther Party or even nonviolent passive resistance movements like the Civil Rights, were infiltrated by the FBI and came under intense scrutiny by law enforcement and by media. All of this sends a very clear message. Then we can think about the realm of popular culture, the stigmatization of angry black athletes being told to shut up and dribble, or the Obama anger translator sketch on Key and Peele, right? What's the takeaway from that long-running sketch? You know, even the African-American individual in the highest office in the land can't actually deign to show anger without penalty. So he has to outsource that, right, to his employee, Luther. So we have this kind of long-running understanding, right, that the costs are really different. The costs, those costs are unequally imposed on Black folks. And so I argue and find evidence, sure enough, that's weighing on the minds of African Americans. So when they're looking at the political landscape, they're thinking, yeah, even if I am dissatisfied by this, even if I feel more targeted by this, more vulnerable to this threat than my white counterparts, I can't necessarily show that grievance in the same way. It's not going to be met with the same affirmation. So that's a significant part of the anger gap. And I think the other significant part is, in order to feel angry about something, I have to see something as a threat in the first place. I have to see it as something that, like, is a violation or a departure from the norm. And then we have to consider the broader ways in which Black people think about politics. You know, when they're looking at things that can get white folks up in arms, are Black people seeing that thing as the system departing from the norm, or are they seeing that as the norm itself? And so given those very tempered expectations Black people tend to carry, given that viewing politics through a racialized lens leads them to think, you know, the system is less responsive to Black people's demands, it's less fair, it's less transparent, it's less just, then I argue there's a sense of resignation, right, tied to a lot of things that might animate anger amongst other folks. And that's really critically important, too. And really critically important is about the kinds of appeals, the kinds of campaigns, the messages that African Americans might be responsive to, and those that really don't strike that responsive chord.
Well, one of the things, as you, you know, as you're talking, I'm reminded of a book. I think we interviewed him, I think, at the time that it came out. Randall Kennedy wrote about the persistence of the color line, and this was about Obama's constraints as, you know, in terms of expressing anger. When we see African American electorate, there's a certain amount, like you say, there's a certain amount of resignation that sort of short circuits the anger, and there's a certain amount of sense of futility maybe in terms of getting angry. Has there ever been a time where it has had an electoral difference, or is this just something that, like, over time has been a consistent feature?
Yeah, so I'm able to look at some nationally representative data going back to 1980, right? So I can kind of trace these trends and express anger and political participation from Reagan all the way up through this dawn of the Trump era. And I'm certainly finding that even looking at kind of Black Democrats and white Democrats and comparing them, right, and kind of holding them equal on every kind of dimension except whether they're expressing anger towards the other party or not. And I'm finding clear differences with Black Democrats expressing much less anger despite expressing more dissatisfaction with those Republican incumbents and candidates. And also the anger that's expressed by Black Democrats and white Democrats having very different effects on their likelihood of turning out. So essentially a completely non-effect on whether Black Democrats turn out or not. And it's a marginally positive effect on white Democrats' likelihood to turn out. And so when we kind of look at that, we can understand why the Black-white turnout gap generally tends to widen under Republican incumbents rather than close. You would imagine if Black Democrats in particular feel particularly threatened by those Republican incumbents, then they'll step up their participation. That's what the conventional wisdom says, right? When you're threatened, you're going to be more likely to act. But if you're not responding to that threat with anger, and I'm finding they're not, then you might not feel more inclination to act. And so we can certainly see the anger gap at least play some type of discernible role in Republican presidents winning more often than not, you know, the last 30 or 40 years. And I think that speaks to a conventional wisdom that obscures the reality about how African Americans are responding to these climates of partisan or political threat. And so, you know, I can't put any number on, well, turnout decreased by this much potentially amongst Black voters, and that would have been the difference. But when we look at margins of victory that have been incredibly narrow, particularly in 2016, it's not hard to imagine that if Black turnout was more animated by the particular threat being positive that year, then it likely would be enough to turn at least one or two battleground states. And in some of these elections, that's more than enough to change the outcome.
Right. I mean, we've talked about, you know, Detroit. We've talked about Milwaukee. We've talked about Philadelphia, where you had, decreased turnout relative to what it was in, let's say, 2008, even 2012, amongst the African-American community. I mean, so... does that, how much of that is applicable to 2020? I mean, you know, in 2016, a lot of this stuff was hypothetical, right? I mean, it was Donald Trump is, you know, acts racist, or Donald Trump talks racist, or, you know, some of his followers are racist, but, people should be, it was harder to be, I think across the board for people to perceive the threat as being real. Everybody was under the assumption, not everybody, but, certainly the conventional wisdom was that Hillary Clinton was going to win, and Donald Trump had a 15% chance of winning. That's a hard thing to get exercised about, unless,
right.
You know, unless that 15% pays off that bet. But I mean, is how much of it is a function of like how real the stakes are in terms of anger? Or is it not a question of how real the stakes are, but the emotional response to those stakes?
Yeah, I think it's more so the latter. I think African-Americans have given two significant indicators about Trump. Right. I think the first one to really kind of internalize for us better understanding what we can expect in terms of turnout across the diverse Democratic coalition in 2020 is that when polled, African-Americans don't necessarily see Trump as so much worse or so much distinct, right, from a status quo. And I think that speaks volumes, right, or just about how kind of resigned or pessimistic or fatalistic, right, African-Americans are about the political context, that many people can see Trump and say, wow, this is a level of open prejudice, right, and animosity and racism that we are not accustomed to. And this is such a departure from even some of the more implicit ways people communicate racist messaging or enact racist policies. African Americans are saying, whether it's implicit or out in your face, right, we kind of expect the system to produce these kinds of outcomes. So he might be a bit more advanced, but he's certainly not so departing from the norm. But I think that doesn't bode well in terms of thinking about an energized Black turnout. But at the same time, certainly see Black people work to preserve and kind of, well, I should say, yeah, to kind of maintain a sense of perseverance. And so even if the specter of 4 more years of Trump does not incite the same emotional intensity, that doesn't mean Black people aren't acutely aware of the continued threats to their well-being that his presidency can represent. And so I think the nuance there really forces the Democrats contending for the Black vote to think about the messaging not being as simple as, well, look, here's the boogeyman that we could posit. Here's all the ways which you need to act to, you know, stave off that boogeyman. Like, doesn't this frustrate you? Doesn't this anger you? Doesn't that incite you? In my research, I find that messages that are more effective at getting out the vote amongst African-Americans are messages rooted in hope and even more prominently pride. And I think it's very possible. In fact, I think it's necessary for the Democratic contenders to be able to craft a message that can instill a sense of community pride within African Americans, even in the face of the existential threats represented by Trump. But it's certainly not the case that you can simply animate this group by relying on the same kind of appeals to anger that will much more effectively animate the white members of the Democratic base.
So when we hear, you know, and when we hear the story, the narrative that that Joe Biden is appealing to African Americans, and largely, you know, this has been tested only basically in the South, right? And maybe there's some regional differences that maybe you could speak to that, and maybe there aren't. But when we hear that Joe Biden is appealing to African Americans in the South, it is because they know the stakes of this and they think Joe Biden is most likely to win. Is that consistent with your research, or is it perhaps that there's something else going on in terms of Joe Biden that your research sort of would cause us to focus on?
Sure. So I definitely think the narrative about Black voters choosing Biden as the more electable candidate, it's important to think about how African Americans do think strategically and pragmatically, but, you know, African Americans are not purely strategic actors, right? Like any other group, they're also thinking about who can better advance, preserve self-interest. So kind of my research would read the differences in what Biden and Sanders craft as their dominant messaging. And I think that Sanders' messaging about speaking to the ills of the system, right, and seeking to animate a sense of indignation about people who are like, enough is enough, right? It's our time to really demand greater economic justice and equity and equity of opportunity and even out the playing fields. We've seen that very, very powerfully motivating for his base, particularly young people across the color line, right? Black young people are just as responsive to that message as any of the young folks. And indeed, I find this particular cohort of young Black Americans, which I looked at as those 29 and under, they don't really exhibit that anchor gap. Right. And that's not a factor of just being young in general, because when I look at young people in past eras, they are exhibiting that same anchor gap. So I think this particular set of young folks is different. And I think, why are they different? You know, I'm sure there's a different set of expectations when you've had a Black president for much of your life. Right. You have a different set of entitlements. And I think you have different kind of changes for this generation that makes anger potentially more salient for them. And that's great for Sanders, but the problem is, right, are they going to be likely to vote? And so far, we haven't seen that youth turnout really increase. In fact, it's looked a little diminished. So I think older Black folks, the appeal to Biden is probably rooted in that sense that when they're hearing those appeals from Sanders, it's not engendering, right, that same anger. It's just kind of animating that sense of resignation. Yeah, Sanders, we understand that the system's unjust, but it's always unjust, right? So that doesn't really move the needle for us. And I think Biden, by crafting just a kind of a more traditional middle-of-the-road message, right, is able to speak in a language that, even if they're not necessarily moved by, inspired by, they're just more familiar with. There's a comfort level there. And so, you know, if I were advising Sanders on ways to better connect with Black voters, I would think about how he can tweak that messaging so he's not simply highlighting the ills that he's looking to rally against, but also highlight the ways in which Black communities, particularly the older Black, have been incredibly resilient in the face of these threats, and to really acknowledge that for Black people, what he's talking about is not like this new thing, but it's something that they've considered, you know, a part of their lives for generations or decades, right? How can he speak to that and give them that sense of, hey, I acknowledge that what I'm saying that is getting other people out of their seats might not get you out of your seats because you've been living with this your whole life. Right. But here are the ways I can acknowledge and admire how you've been fighting against it. Here are the ways I can kind of take how you've been fighting against this at this localized community level and make that a national movement.
I would imagine, I mean, there's a couple of things that I want to talk about, because I want to talk about the durability of that change. I mean, it's fascinating theory, the idea that that on some level, younger African Americans have a higher expectations because of Obama, or maybe because of just, you know, generational shifts. I mean, I think, you know, we had the baby boomers were sort of dominating our culture for a long time. I would imagine bringing a similar perspective as their parents, which is, you know, you're talking now, you know, pre-New Deal folks growing up in that era, growing up in Jim Crow, still with that sort of like sense of, you know, of maybe on some level of resignation to, or maybe resignation is not the right word, but a sense that, like, you know, there's something systemic here, and, you know, expecting more out of these politicians is a fool's errand on some level. The does the I want to swing back to that, but I want to stay with is the message that you're talking about, is there also something, is Sanders inhibited by his issues with Obama, in that he cannot sort of like play to African-American pride in that, in Obama as a president, in the way that Biden can?
So I think that's a really good question, right? To what extent is that Sanders always kind of being kind of held back by that, constrained by that, because as much as he can tout, right, the good of Obama, he can never have that more intimate connection. But I think what's really critical is that I think Biden's ability to benefit from this Biden connection, his Obama connection, goes deeper than simply being the VP. I've been thinking a lot about, you know, ground game and that real, you know, not very sexy, but very critical work of just mobilizing people in communities. And one thing that I think gets lost about Obama is the intentionality of going into Black neighborhoods that had often been ignored by national Democratic campaigns, either due to, you know, people with not very consistent records of voting, or particularly neighborhoods with higher than average rates of former felons, which may or may not be eligible to vote, and saying, hey, those votes that are able to come out of those neighborhoods matter, right? So I think that's really critical for Obama being able to successfully build up that multiracial coalition, right? Simply having a very broad approach to the ground game. So I think definitely Biden still benefits from that, because you think about the institutional memory from those neighborhoods, right? It's like, this was a set of folks that came to us and implored us to vote and told us about the value of our voices when others hadn't given us that. And so I'm hearing about, you know, which campaigns are spending in which areas, but I think there are still some reverberating effects that Biden gets to benefit from, because he's connected to that element of Obama, right, and not just the Obama presidency.
So and also so the entire Obama operation on some level. I mean, because Biden, as far as I can tell, has no ground game. I mean, and you know, like, I mean, honestly, like, I, you know, like, just the number of offices, the number of people who are canvassing,
sure,
seems to be sort of shockingly limited, and yet doing incredibly well in South Carolina, for instance, doing very well throughout the South. I mean, in Texas with African Americans, in California with African Americans, that the residual effects from not just the Obama presidency but the Obama campaigns just benefits Biden in this instance.
For sure. Yeah. And so I think that for Sanders to be able to counteract that would require, you know, not kind of any kind of shift in his big broad messaging or the cultivation of his national persona, but can he make the kind of inroads in those neighborhoods, right, that were kind of silently but steadily really critical to building up that coalition? Because the point you made is an important one. If Biden hasn't actually continued that work, then the potential reverberating kickback he's getting in this primary can certainly have a, you know, shelf life. And so I imagine those folks weren't necessarily tapped into by the Clinton coalition, right? One of the many factors that shaped the turnout figures that we saw. And so if they could make a concerted effort by Sanders' ground team to go into those same neighborhoods and say, hey, you were hit up, you know, 8-12 years ago, not really much since. We're here, right? How can we learn from you? How can we draw on your vote? I really think that could be critical in a way that we wouldn't necessarily see because of national discourse. But one thing to really keep in mind is, you know, how attuned are Black people, how influenced, I should say, are Black people to some of the national discourses characterizing these candidates versus the kinds of more intimate that they're receiving from civic and community religious leaders, right, and from the kind of direct or indirect feedback they get about these candidates based on the impressions formed within those local spaces. And so I think it's those local spaces that are critical. If the national discourse mattered as much, then the whole national narrative about Biden being done after New Hampshire probably would have mattered more for Black votes in these subsequent elections. So clearly we have to recognize that disconnect and see the constraints on trying to appeal to African Americans through the kind of national discourse, but also the opportunity to be able to subside that and do better than people might expect you to do because of that face-to-face contact you've been able to cultivate.
How durable do you think this gap that you see in terms of the youth is? In other words, 29 years and younger African Americans seem to respond to the sense of like, you're getting screwed over, and have the same expectations that they shouldn't, as you know, as the white voters who, you know, at least in terms of like, you know, on the Democratic side. How durable is that? I mean, you know, if the theory is that these are people who grew up with the Obama presidency, and so their expectations might be higher, their expectations might have been elevated. I mean, part of it also, I think, is, you know, that people under the age of 30 are getting a raw deal relative to people who were, you know, over the age of 40, let's say, or 45. Right. And I mean, that's a material difference. You know, relative to, you know, and maybe that raw deal is less, you know, is sort of evened out the playing field in some way, and is a great equalizer. And I think to a certain extent too, we have this dynamic of, you know, the boomers' sensibility is, more prevalent, or I should say is more prevalent to people, you know, 30 and above, than it is for people who are 30 and below. How durable do you think it is what we're seeing with these? I mean, is this just going to be a cohort that goes through the system and they're going to be, sort of more open to, anger appeals? Or is this like the new norm? As those people get older, the younger people will also continue to sort of like follow that trajectory.
Yeah, it's a really important question, one I'm still wrestling with. You know, one thing that's important for me to note is that, you know, across this young cohort of Black folks that really aren't expressing anger any differently than white folks, at least my set of data from 2016, even that anger that they express is more likely to translate to actions that kind of challenge the system rather than actions that work within the system. So I think that's the challenge for political campaigns looking to tap into that young anger, or that anger amongst young Black folks, that they're more likely to go onto a site of protest or a demonstration than a voting booth, right? So how do you translate that kind of elevated sense of expectation of what's possible from government and that willingness to get indignant about politics into electoral action? But in terms of whether that's durable, right, or whether they'll kind of ultimately develop this sense of resignation with electoral politics and kind of look no different from other Black age cohorts, I think there's a lot of dynamism there. And I think the kind of battle for the soul of the Democratic Party can really inform what we see from this emerging generation of Black folks. They certainly have more skepticism, I'd say, about the Democratic establishment than other cohorts. I think you saw that in 2016 with the real scrutiny of Clinton's record during the, you know, 90s Clinton era from younger Black folks. You're seeing that with younger Black folks, at least in the online spaces that I'm privy to, you know, very much scrutinizing Biden's record and on the crime bill in the mid-90s. They're saying, you know, we don't have the luxury of saying, oh, it's a different time and we'll look away, right? We're still dealing with the reverberating consequences of these actions that these people took, these actions that were clearly harmful to us then, continue to be harmful to us now. We're not going to give anyone a free pass, right? So I definitely think that's where the appeal of someone that's more of an outside like Sanders comes in. The question is, right, where is the Democratic Party going to pivot? The Republican Party had this kind of, you know, revolution in the form of the Tea Party. And despite some initial resistance, the Republican Party kind of established a largely fell in line, right? And we kind of saw the Republican Party now move closer to this kind of farther to the right heart of the base. The Democratic Party has its own version of the revolution in the form of the Justice Democrats, right? The Sanders Revolution. And you see, I see a lot more resistance from the Democratic leadership machinery to kind of responding to and absorbing that, kind of moving closer to the left, the true preference point of its base. I think Black young emergent Democrats are going to be particularly attuned to the resistance of the Democratic machinery. And if that machinery continues to resist and not just kind of adapt and move closer to the left, I think it has real meaningful consequences for Black people's willingness to be kind of consistent, loyal voters to the Democratic Party. You think about vote capture, right? Black people generally across the board don't really have two options, right? The Democratic Party is typically got to be the lesser of two evils, but there's always the choice to simply not vote. And I think that's what's kind of at stake here, particularly for young Black folks, but certainly not just young Black folks. The Democratic base is going to be increasingly racially diverse and increasingly younger, right? So you've got a lot of people that are on the fence in terms of will they be consistent supporters, which is necessary for the Democratic Party to continue to be viable. And if they're reading that struggle for the heart of the party as, you know, again, this machinery that's set up to just not be responsive to our preference points, then they're not going to have that same loyalty with the past and racism. That's going to have, you know, immense consequences. So I think for Black people, in particular of this age cohort, certainly I'm thinking about whether that resignation will set in or if it looks like for this generation more like a sense of fatigue, right, over time. Like, oh, you know, we're really not getting the traction we would have liked, so we're going to continue to think about alternate ways of engaging in politics. But I think the consequences are kind of just as clear and apparent for the Democratic Party, because you just look at the basic demographics of the country, right? If they don't have the loyal support of this emergent generation that's going to be, you know, much more progressive on social and economic issues, then how can they continue to win?
Good question. We're about to sort of, you know, we'll have a little bit of an experiment with that, quite possibly, with that very question over the next 6 to 9 months. We'll see. The book is The Anger Gap, How Race Shapes Emotion in Politics. We'll put a link to this at majority.fm. Davin L. Phoenix, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
I appreciate the chance to talk with you.
Bye-bye. There you have it.
And it's interesting to think about the impact of progress on young people, because I often think of the most immiserated people being the most angry. And, you know, millennials are angry because we're getting screwed worse than our parents' generation. But the idea that, you know, seeing some progress in the form of Obama or what have you has inspired people to ask for more is also interesting.
That's actually, I mean, from what I remember in my college days of studying about revolutions, that's actually where they happen. Like when there is a little bit of benefit given to the people, when there's a little bit of loosening of like the grip, or when like there's one thing, like getting one thing begets the desire for more things.
Especially when they try to take things away from you.
Well, but if I remember correctly, it's not so much the taking away after they've got it. It's actually getting more and just being like, hey, wait a second. Like, it's almost as if folks don't have the ability to imagine what certain benefits are like. And when they get a taste of it, you start to realize like, hey, wait a second, this is possible. We've been denied it for a long time, but it is possible. And we want more. Like, that dynamic is actually my understanding. At least this is, you know, this is, I was in college a long time ago. But that was the sort of like current sort of social science on revolutions, that they happen when you loosen or when you give a taste of like other benefits.
Another thing to think about is, just plug my literary hangover now, the Salem Witch Trials episode. So the Salem Witch Trials were in the 1690s, the Great Awakening, the sort of evangelical awakening in the 1730s. Both of those things started very similarly with basically aberrant behavior by young people. And what determines whether it's going to be a witch hunt or a Great Awakening is basically how the elders interpret it. Is it something that needs to be exorcised, or is it something that needs to be sort of exorcised, like Exorcism of Emily Rose, or is it something that needs to be sort of like captured by the church and used to regenerate it? And it looks like we're going with the witch hunt model.
What determines that, though?
What determines that specifically?
The response. Like, is it just that, like, we have to go with it, we have no chance, or that we do have the ability to repress it?
At least in that specific case, it might be because there was a living memory of witch hunts, and we can't go down that route, so we're going to have to figure out another way to handle this, possibly. I'm not sure exactly what the difference is, but that is at least the difference. The different
responses.
The key decider is the adult's interpretation of it.
Well, the adults are not responding so great right now, as far as I can tell. Well, we'll talk more about this over the next couple of days, right? Because we are at an inflection point, I think, in terms of the Democratic primary race. And it's possible that we've already passed the inflection point, but we don't know it yet. But we will certainly, get a sense of things tomorrow night. And we're going to do some live coverage of the primaries tomorrow night. The biggest ones from the perspective of, there's only two candidates left in the race, essentially. I think Tulsi Gabbard is still technically in the race, but I mean, I don't know that anybody would argue that she's viable at this point. We're going to see. I mean, Bernie Sanders needs to win Michigan and he needs to win Washington State. And the polling doesn't look so great now. I can tell you that the polling, I don't know if it was the day before going into Michigan in 2016, looked awfully similar. And Sanders eked it out by, I think, a point and a half. If Sanders wins Michigan and Washington, regardless of the margin, you want him to win big, obviously, but if it just ekes it out, then I think, you know, going into the debate on Sunday, although it's been sort of converted into a more of like a fireside chat nap type of situation, because I think the DNC realizes, and this is, you know, highly problematic, when you feel like you have to make your debate sort of like a little bit more comfy for one of the people there because you're a little bit concerned that they can't make through it. Understand you don't necessarily have the same latitude when it comes to debating the Republican. But, I mean,
they don't care.
I don't know if they've been, like, if it's been locked in. And I imagine, and I don't know when it will be. Maybe he's waiting to roll this out for his speech, or maybe he's waiting till after tomorrow to roll it out, which I imagine he is. But Trump's going to come out and he's going to mock Joe Biden for this. They had to have Sleepy Joe sit down. Now, I don't think that the mocking of Biden in this way is really actually going to have an impact. The mocking itself in the context of the election. I just don't think that is going to do it. I do think that if Biden is the nominee, I think the reality of it will have more of a, but like, in other words, his limited ability to, you know, go to five states in a day and campaign in five places in a day, four places in a day, three places in a day, two in a week. I mean, who knows? Could have implications, but we'll see. There's so many factors right now, and it's too early to say that Sanders is out of it. We got to wait until tomorrow, I think, to really make an assessment. Things have really turned. I said on Friday I thought that, Warren's endorsement was really important as an intervening event that could change the trajectory of the race. I said this actually Tuesday night at 3 a.m. on MSNBC. Changed the trajectory of the race in such a way that Sanders gets a boost in Michigan and Washington. It's not guaranteed that that would have happened, but I think it was an important element. And then we get to the debates. But even as we get into the general election, and I don't know if the polling on this impacts people. I have not perceived this as like sort of some type of conventional wisdom, but it appears the things that the Democratic nominee will face in dealing with Donald Trump are very different looking today than they were 6 weeks ago. Because of coronavirus, because of one, the actual impact it's going to have from a health standpoint, the anxiety it creates amongst people, and from an economic perspective, the idea of a recession happening appears to be, a legitimate possibility with the combination of the coronavirus and what's happening with oil prices, apparently. So who knows? There's a lot of things to talk about. We will be talking about them in the fun half today. We'll be talking about them tomorrow. Nomi Kantz is going to stop by for our coverage tomorrow night. Tomorrow we'll be talking more about this stuff. And so stick with us, and we shall see. We're going to take a quick break in a second. Also, remind you that your support makes this show possible. You can support this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. We will be here every day giving you analysis of things, some news updates, interviews like the one we had today on the anger gap, a fascinating perspective on this stuff. That frankly, I don't feel like I've been made aware of that type of dynamic. I don't know that I've read anything like that before. About how, the closest thing I've come from it is like, I remember coming in and talking to Michael, used to work downstairs. Do you remember Mike? And after Trump won, and going like, man, can't believe it. He goes, I can effing believe it.
Phil of Two Dope Boys was the exact same way.
Yeah, this country is effing
Black
racist.
People were unsurprised by
Trump
winning.
And I mean, there that was like a little bit of a hint about that. You can support the show by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. We bring you all of these different perspectives. We try to every day. You can get the free show, free of commercials, and then you get the fun half. And then, you get like a little bonuses every now and then. Like we post a video of we did with this, and we're going to be doing more of that as time goes on and I get a little more sleep. I'm dizzy. I'm still dizzy. Speaking of Nomiki Kantz, check out the Nomiki Show, as it were, on Patreon.com and on YouTube. Also, check out the AM Quickie, available every morning by 8 a.m., 6-7 minutes. Cranking it out. People are loving it. You can listen on our app at majorityapp.com, or you can just sign up a podcast completely free. AMQuickie.com, or you can find it on any of your podcast subscription platforms, whatever you call that. And JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. TMBS will not be on Tuesday night this week. It'll be on Wednesday night this week, and it will feature Matt.
Ooh, I think Liz Franzik, and I'm not sure. I can't remember who the other guest is.
So there you have that. Check that out. The Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. And Jamie, the Antifada.
Oh, yes. So this week on the Antifada, I spoke with some organizers from the Wildcat strike that's going on at UC Santa Cruz right now about their goals, how they got to this point, what it means for labor organizing at large and education in this country, and how excited they were when Bernie tweeted in support of the strike. That's coming out on Wednesday. Also, still recommend our main ep and our bonus ep from last week, wherein we speak with Shuja Hader about the Bernie Sanders movement and what it means to the larger fight for socialism. Patreon.com/TheAntifada.
That's what Saul says to me when he wants to watch TV. Can I watch an ep? It's just not something that we said as kids. Like we never said
watch like an episode.
Well, yeah, because you couldn't enjoy things in episode contents back in the day. Really,
you couldn't like you had no option.
Yeah,
like
it has to be on the TV.
Right, like yeah. The fact that it's episode. Like couldn't there was no podcast. Yeah. You know, like episode, you would just it was such a formal word. It wasn't like a unit of ingestion. As
no,
it
it's
were.
Just like, can I watch TV now?
I remember when I first downloaded X-Files episodes onto my hard drive, and it felt like the most high tech thing ever,
and probably illicit.
It was, yeah. Anyway, Literary Hangover this Saturday, Widow Ranter by Aphra Behn. It's a play, but from about like the end of the 17th century about Bacon's Rebellion. Not very historically accurate, but we are going to talk about. Race and gender in colonial Virginia and how, for instance, white women were tax exempt because they were sort of like wives of their that economic productivity went to their husbands. But black women had to pay taxes on their wealth to the state of Virginia. So there you go. Or the Commonwealth or whatever it is.
All right, folks.
The other thing she...
What is that?
I don't know where that's coming
from. Damn it. I got too many taps.
Yeah, there you go. What are you doing? You can't figure out where you...
I got all the tabs open for the sound.
Oh, folks. Anyways, here we go. Oh yeah!
Return of my band this week, Thursday, in Greenpoint, which is in North Brooklyn, at a venue called the Kingsland.
Why are you doing it way up there, dude?
Well, there aren't any venues left in Park Slope, Sam, in case you were wondering.
I don't know where. I don't know. Go Fort Greene.
There's nothing down here anymore. But
Gowanus.
We're playing with some bands from Jersey, from Asbury Park, where I briefly lived when I was working on a previous media project. And we're going to be on opening at 8 o'clock. And you can come see us, $10 advance, $13 day of show.
That's a deal.
You guys should cover that Joe Hill Pie in the Sky song, yeah. Brendan, I think.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
All right. See you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance. My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, going to take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabs.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already. Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.